This is a reading called Letting Go by Reverend Thomas Rhodes. Let us enter into a time of meditation, contemplation, and prayer. Feel the earth beneath your feet as it supports you. Feel the love of this community as it surrounds and unfolds you. Feel your breath as it flows in and out of your body. Listen to your heartbeat. Listen to your heart. Take another breath and hold it. The air you hold in your body is the most precious thing in the world, for your very life depends on it. And yet, none of us can hold on to it for more than a moment, or else we would strangle and die. What is most precious to us must be released, so that we may live and live fully. Look into your heart. Find what is there and hold it. The love you hold within your heart is the most precious thing in the world. And yet no one can hold on to it any more than your heart can withhold its blood. Or else we would die from loneliness and misery. What is most precious to us must be shared so that we may love and love fully. Look into your life at those things that are most precious to you and look again. You will find that their value lies not in being held, but in being shared. Life, love, laughter, longing. May we share these precious gifts that they may return to us multiplied by measure. Now on to the sermon. The theme of our worship this month is letting go. But right at the onset, I wish to name what might be the elephant in the room, to state that I don't believe in letting go of my outrage about the extensive history of racism and murder in this country. Names must be named and not forgotten. But work must be done now to change what happens today and going forward, including being present for people who are so lost in their private, terrified shame that they endlessly seek to harm others so they can feel better. If my outrage overwhelms me and I wallow in it, instead of letting it inspire action, I don't believe that is useful for anyone. It's especially not useful to me. It would cause me to suffer a great deal to endlessly embody that kind of rage and tension, and there'd be no purpose to it. So I think the lesson is letting go of the self-indulgence around my outrage is useful. Instead, I wish to let the outrage propel me to be of use in the world. So back to letting go. Letting go. What does that even mean? And how does one do it? I mean, is it even advisable? In this sermon, I'm going to describe my point of view of letting go, what some big roadblocks are, and how one might drive right through them but never exceed the speed limit. I myself had an opportunity to experience letting go just a couple of weeks ago. This is true. Somehow, I thought that the worship theme of the month for First Parish was prayer. I learned just a couple of weeks ago that it was actually letting go. Yes. At a crossroads, I had the choice of continuing my prayer sermon or shifting to letting go. I was even told I could make that choice. And I wanted to do the service on prayer. How delightfully subversive. But actually very meaningful to me. It's funny how often the universe lets me experience a demonstration of the very lesson that I apparently need to learn in that moment. to lessen. Universe exclaims, please open yourself up to the new present. Please let go of what could have been. The first time I naively signed up to be a worship host of a summer service some years ago, I missed the email that outlined my duties about how to prepare for the service because I had been on a trip outside the country and I didn't notice its arrival. Blithely showing up at the service 20 minutes before it began that Sunday, I quickly realized that I had not done what I was supposed to do. I immediately began to sweat profusely and felt very awkward and embarrassed. It was kind of like one of those dreams where you're suddenly naked or today's the final and you didn't know. But because I had recently learned at the time that a good way to handle stress is to breathe deeply 10 to 20 times, I literally had just learned that at a conference. I went in the bathroom and I tried it. Shockingly, it worked amazingly well. My nervous system calmed right down. And so when I got my wits about me, I saw that the theme of the day was perfectionism. I was able to use the experience from the preceding half hour, from my preceding half hour, and wrap that into the service in a joyful, welcoming way. I completely went with the humor of the situation that the universe was sending my way. Lesson: ride the wave of reality in the here and now. Experience the roller coaster of feelings that are real right now. It might even be okay. And aren't those nice stories, gosh darn? But what about situations which feel deeply challenging? What about those? What about something I feel afraid to let go of? What about a situation where I might have to disregard something that I deeply believe? What about a situation where the sadness and disappointment I might feel if I let go of something that feels like an option I don't even want to consider taking? It might even feel like I shouldn't take it. It might feel wrong. It might even feel risky to take it. It might feel stupid to let go. What about those situations? So what does one do to let go? How does one even do that? So let's ask the important question in each unique situation. Just what is it that I'm actually letting go of? Can I hear the answer in my head and my heart, or am I too stressed to hear it? When we're afraid, the blood actually doesn't flow so well to the prefrontal cortex, the front of the brain, where we do our higher thinking. And this leads us more to our animal reactions rather than any kind of analytical thinking, which makes it hard to think straight sometimes. So here's a good way into that dilemma. Why not think about it this way? Isn't it in our humanity to create a story to explain the world to ourselves, no matter how small or how large the question? We are all born scientists asking why something occurs. And sometimes the stories that we write are accurate, and sometimes they're not. I'm sure the mothers of Columbus's crew knew that their sons would fall off the edge of the earth and die. At one time, that was a true story, which very few people doubted. And then those stories become beliefs. I find the word story useful because it at least introduces the possibility of doubt. Beliefs don't often have a lot of doubts, unless one is doubting Thomas, of course. But stories can. And of course, when my own story becomes a belief, somehow it seems so right, real, it's obvious, it's important. I don't have any doubts. So I'll often ask myself, just what is the story that I'm believing right now? It's a very useful question. It helps me stand back a step. This is important because when thoughts become beliefs, when I start believing my own stories, I react to them as though they are deeply correct, and the brain actually affects our ability to do that. So here's an example of what I'm talking about. Any of us can think of some future calamity that could happen. And if we stay with that imagined idea long enough, which is truly not that long, our bodies begin to react as though the story is real. As a result, I can begin to feel anxious, hopeless, and vigilant. This is all an imagined idea, and I know it full well. What if the plane crashes? What if I become a widow? What if? What if? And then this, and then that. Even saying these words, I can feel agitation in my chest. The longer I linger there, the more my body reacts. And so it's the physical feelings that we have as a result of these thoughts, which then cue us to believe our stories are real. Does that make sense? It's like our physical reactions feel like proof. Like, yeah. When we feel afraid, the trigger for the fear seems genuine. And it's shockingly common that I don't even realize that I'm essentially the author of my own misery here. My thoughts became a story. The story scared me. My body reacted as though the story was real. I start to believe my own story. I suffered. So it is challenging to let go of a belief, even if it's untrue. Some scientists telling the mothers of Columbus's crew that the world is round probably didn't immediately help them relax. You can begin to see that in certain instances, letting go of an untrue story would be quite challenging once it becomes a belief. If I don't take the time to explore that, well, just forget it. And as each of us knows, my stories are real. So here's the lesson. It can take courage to examine my thoughts and beliefs. I'll share such a story of my own creation and what eventually happened as a result. I have one sister who is 2 years older than I am. And when I was a senior in college, she ran away to Singapore to get married, essentially, never to return to live in the States again. And that was also back in the day when people wrote letters, and I wasn't actually a very good letter writer, and seldom used the phone for expensive transatlantic calls. As a younger sister who was studying psychology and relationships, I truly believed that I knew exactly what my sister should be giving me in order for us to have a good relationship. Perhaps you can recognize someone you know in some of what I'm about to say. I knew that my sister should treat me like a dear younger sister, eternally caring. She should join me in my pursuit and curiosity of psychological education and understanding. She should use psychological language comfortably and that it should make sense to her. She should have a limitless capacity for listening and believing everything I said. And of course, she should do all this while living halfway around the world and barely seeing me. Lest you think these are the ravings of a 3-year-old, let me assure you they were not. This is what my 20s consisted of with her. This all seemed so reasonable to me, I didn't really see much beyond it. And what follows is what happened to me when I was 36. See how exposing I am to myself up here? Luckily, at the time, I had a wise therapist who suggested that when my sister came to town on an upcoming work trip, she stop in for a session with me. I was delighted that my therapist was going to explain me to my sister. Finally! Instead, I left that powerful meeting shocked at how my sister had been explained to me. After I was led to think about her life and what my behavior might feel like coming towards her, I was stunned. After the meeting, I straightforwardly told her I was going to change my outlook, and I did. I gave her some sincere apologies and really did change my behavior starting with a visit to Singapore for the first time ever within the year. So what actually was I letting go of here? My powerful wishes, a kind of a know-it-all energy, a cluelessness about the beauty and necessity of mutuality, my certainty that I knew exactly what I needed to make me happy, and most of all, the belief that she had to be a certain way for me to be okay, which I always call the Vidal Sassoon School of Mental Health, for those of you, those of you who remember that. So, hang on here. I'd like to say it was wonderful. Yay! Letting go is so wonderful. But I'm going to introduce a complication instead. Actually, what followed was a sense of loss and emptiness. I knew what not to do, but I didn't know what to do. I had been so certain of my own story. I believed it was completely correct. It never occurred to me that my certainty itself was the real problem. And I was really shocked at the loss and emptiness because everyone speaks about letting go in such euphoric tones. For me, that wasn't the case. In retrospect, I realized I entered a time of grief. So here's one thing you might think to prepare for. Letting go can temporarily bring grief. Letting go of what seems fundamentally true is rather huge. So even if a part of us knows that letting go is truly the right thing to do and we may sincerely want to, we probably shouldn't be so surprised that there is also a part of us that feels differently. Very sad. But luckily, grief is something that humans mostly recover from if we keep our eyes open. And what I mean by that is this. I've been so focused on what my sister should do, I really barely noticed what she was actually doing. During my period of grief, I really tried to keep my eyes open about what was real and right in front of me. Carefully looking, especially while I was visiting her in Singapore, resulted in feeling much more settled in a realistic and loving sisterly relationship. I could see her being loving to me in her own particular way, which turned out to be quite wonderful. And isn't that what each of us does anyway? We love another in the way that feels right to us. There was true mutuality, which could not have happened had I not been willing to let go of my previous beliefs. So I think the lesson here, being willing to take a chance to see what is in the real world, rather than continuing on my path of certainty that I needed to control events, is what can help me let go. All right, now, how was I able to do that? What enabled me to turn on a dime, literally, and acknowledge that I had made mistakes after spending so many years not being troubled at all about my beliefs? I suppose the short answer has to do with the resilience of the human spirit. We sometimes enjoy moments of sudden clarity, don't we? Even when, by rights, they shouldn't appear. And I was suddenly flooded with the knowledge that I had been deeply mistaken. But what one does with that moment of clarity is really the question, isn't it? I suppose that I could have seen the truth and run screaming from the room with my head in my hands. So what enabled me to stay with it rather than be overwhelmed by shame and embarrassment about it? This is a big thing I'm about to say. I think that self-compassion is really the key to living well, especially when one is letting go. Now, self-compassion is not the same thing as self-pity. It's not even selfish. It's not conceited. It's not grandiose. It's not defensive. It is simply caring about oneself in a similar way to the way that I care about anyone I love. Now, the opposite of that, of course, is harsh self-judgment. And when I experience that, I become entirely self-focused because it's so painful. I likely become defensive in response, literally, to my own thoughts, my own self-judgment, which ratchets up the pain of the overall experience. And in fact, I become less emotionally available to the person I have wronged because harsh self-judgment distracts me away from anyone else. If I develop a habit of treating myself kindly, letting go becomes much more possible. It's less frightening, less shaming. It actually enables me to be way less self-involved. If I have less fear looking clearly at how I have hurt someone, I'm less overwhelmed by the experience. One of my favorite sayings about myself and anyone else is, and I don't say this with irony or humor, it seemed like a good idea at the time. Because it did. It's often the way I look at past decisions that turned out to be mistakes. I realized that at the time, that's what I was capable of. And I try to hold on to that while I simultaneously feel regret for something. I try to make amends and change my behavior in the present. And actually, half of you may find this really odd or icky or something, but I'll be honest here. I actually call myself sweetheart in my head when I'm talking to myself. So there are some quite common roadblocks to letting go. One is the sense it'd be wrong to do so. What am I afraid would happen if I let go? It's not unusual to fear that something awful would happen if we did let go. Now, sometimes it turns out that loyalty is a major component of this dilemma. We tie things together in our hearts, and we worry that it would be disloyal if we were to grow and change. And therefore, letting go can be a very hard thing to do. One example of this, I think, would be Derek Black, a young man who grew up in Florida in what is essentially the royal family of white nationalists. His father had been a Ku Klux Klan grandmaster and founded Stormfront, a neo-Nazi website. David Duke is his godfather. And as a teen, Derek famously hosted a daily radio show promoting these ideas to other young people. But when Derek went to college, just a small college in Florida, he developed real relationships with fellow students who were Jewish and Muslim. A few of them knew what he was and insisted on treating him as a person of value anyway. Over time, he realized he could not continue spouting the family line. Could he let those ideas go? What would the cost in loyalty be? Spoiler alert, he did part with his family's beliefs and now has a PhD in Muslim history. A book just came out about him. But I really wonder what it was like for him to let go of his ideas. Certainly, Derek must have struggled with challenging loyalty issues. Now, this is an extreme example. Yet many of us struggle with the same concern. If I let go, whom do I gain and whom do I lose? Whom do I please and whom do I disappoint? Will we no longer be connected if I move away from someone else's beliefs that we formerly shared? Often it makes no difference if the loyalty is to a deceased or living family member. And to make matters even more complicated, we often don't consciously realize this is even the issue. We just know it doesn't feel right to change. Another roadblock is letting go of the dread of embarrassment. Well, if I let go of that idea, what does it mean that I believed it all those years? What does that say about me? How does that make me look? How humiliating. I'm not sure I can handle that. And especially if I'm a person who grew up in a family that tossed shame around like a hot potato, where blame was the family currency, the consequence of letting go can feel pretty excruciating. And then there's what I call magical thinking about how the world really works. People have said to me on many occasions, with a straight face, I can't give up control of that. And of course, most of the time, the blunt response to that would be, you aren't giving up control, you are giving up the illusion of control. I mean, who among us can really control anything important? I mean, I can choose to have tea or coffee for breakfast, but I have no say about the health of people I love. In my work as a therapist, I have from time to time gently given that blunt response, only to see the client panic about the truth of what I had just said. There are many people to whom the essential truth of that never entered their minds. They really live with the sense that they are controlling events by their thoughts. These might also be the people who make silent bargains. If I constantly worry about someone, that will make them safe. Many people hold that belief. I'm not making this up. They cling to those bargains as though they are real. Fear is a powerful motivator, isn't it? And what about age-related challenges? Acceptance of what I can no longer reliably do. As a woman in my 60s, I certainly know the speed of retrieving information from my memory bank has slowed down. And are there other things I can't reliably do? Am I willing to admit them? Do I fear it would bring too much grief or humiliation into my consciousness? I mean, what does letting go look like in those situations? The answer lies in what my beliefs are. Back to our original question, just what is it that I'm actually letting go of? What are my beliefs? Do I believe old people have no value, so I don't want to be one? All I have to do is remember Nancy Moore's delightful conversations to counter that. And if you're new, she's an extremely elderly, longtime member of our congregation who recently passed away, sharp as a tack. Do I believe that I will be blamed and pitied if I'm old? Well, self-compassion addresses that, doesn't it? And how about the slogan, it's better than the alternative, which points out that early death is the only solution to aging. Letting go in this circumstance is actually letting go of the denial I have about it. And perhaps letting go of the denial of aging can lead to feeling graceful and loving about it. If I let go of denial, I can more readily attend to anything that can support the quality of my life every day until my last. I certainly hope so. In this sermon, I started with the idea that sometimes letting go can be exhilarating and easy, even funny. And then I invited us to consider all the times that is really not the case. The first step in a more challenging example is slowing down. Defining just what letting go is by asking the question, just what is it I'm actually letting go of? Looking at our beliefs and considering that they might be untrue stories opens me up. Learning that the brain and the body play a part in this feels calming to me. I'm not unique or crazy because I do that. I'm a normal person. Learning that grief might follow letting go can help me feel less blindsided by it if it occurs. I can anticipate it as a phase of the process. During that time, I benefit by keeping my eyes wide open to what really is. We connected self-compassion to well-being in the midst of these challenges by looking at what harsh self-judgment does instead. Self-compassion has many, many benefits to those around us, as well as to ourselves. We looked at some specific roadblocks, as well as what might help us with them. It's been a privilege to share with you my thoughts, my stories, and my beliefs today. We will now enter a time of silent meditation and reflection.